This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the three editors of the newly released Look for Me in the Whirlwind.
It's the collective biography of the New York City Panther 21, who were framed up, imprisoned for 2 years, and then acquitted by a jury in less than an hour. It was one of the fundamental cases of the 60s. Its lessons still pertain. The title is Look for Me in the Whirlwind. It tells the story of the Panther 21 and much more.
We talk with the author of Democracy in Chains, the deep history of the radical right's stealth plan for America.
Nancy McLean puts it all together. This is like a evolving coup that's going on now. The bad guys are halfway there.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The Black Panther Party was formed by community college students in Oakland, California in 1966, the year after Malcolm X was murdered in New York City. Its original name was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. The party set an example by its community programs and courage in declaring that it would defend itself against police brutality. It spread eastward from California to New York, where chapters were organized in Brooklyn and Harlem, where Malcolm X was from. The Panthers frightened Americans' elite. J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI set out to destroy them, and eventually succeeded. A great courtroom battle took place in New York City shortly after the establishment of these chapters. 21 Black Panthers were framed up on baseless conspiracy charges. They spent 2 years in prison, including 1 year on trial. The jury was out for only 1 hour and acquitted them totally of all the baseless charges. The collective story of the New York City Black Panthers and their trial is told in the newly reissued book, Look for Me in the Whirlwind. The book is edited by Dekwi Kioni Sadiki and Matt Meyer. It has a foreword by Imam Jamil Alamin, formerly H. Rapp Brown, the former head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who's now in prison for life in Georgia. It also contains an afterword by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Joining us in the studio today are Sekou Odinga, a former Panther and political prisoner, as well as the book's editors. Matt Meyer is a New York City-based educator, organizer, and author, who serves as War Resisters International Africa Support Network Coordinator. Dekwi Kioni Sadiki is the chair of the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee and was a leader of the Sekou Odinga Defense Committee, which waged a successful campaign for the release of her husband. And Sekou Odinga was a member of Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity, a founding member of the New York chapter of the Black Panther Party, as well as the Black Panther International Section, and a member of the Panther 21. Sekou, Dekwi, and Matt, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You have all produced a book of great significance that chronicles underreported movements and repression in the United States. How did this collaboration come to be? How do you all know each other?
Thank you for inviting us to talk about this historic book. And this book covers a period that created U.S.-held political prisoners and prisoners of war. And so I met Matt doing that work around U.S.-held political prisoners and prisoners of war. And that's the same way I met Sekou Odinga.
Originally, I had done several books for PM Press, with PM Press, Let Freedom Ring, which is this sort of encyclopedic anthology of documents from the movements to free political prisoners over the last 25 years. So it looks at contemporary history. And because of that, and because of my work with Dekwi, with the campaigns to free Sekou, to free Russell Maroon Schultz, to free Oscar Lopez Rivera, to free all U.S. political prisoners, some of the editors at PM came to me and said, you know, there's this important book, Look for Me in the Whirlwind, the collective autobiography of the Panther 21, the New York 21, which is essentially not available. It's been long out of print and impossible to find. I mean, Sekou can tell his own stories about trying to find the book that that he and his colleagues and comrades and co-defendants were featured in. But it was near impossible to find. They said, let's put this back into print. And essentially the idea moved from there to saying we can't just put this book back into print. We need to talk to, we need to chronicle where the 21 were now, and for many of them, say Ku at the forefront, where they are now are either still struggling for liberation and freedom, or in prison, struggling for freedom for their own and their people's. So it became clear that we had to create what we call a twofer, two books for the price of one, two books in one, the full reprint of the collective autobiography from the early 1970s, and these close to 200 pages of new reflections from Sekou, from Daruba, from Jamal Joseph, as well as some content from some of the Panther 21 who had passed, Afeni Shakur, Kwesi Balogun, and others.
Sekou, I'm curious, when did you first read the original book and what kind of impact did it have on you?
I first read the book, I guess it was right after it came out, back in 71, I guess it was. I remember right, I'm not certain. I was over in Africa when I first got hold to the book. We started talking about bringing this book back, Daruba Ben Wahad and myself, a while back, for the reason that Matt just mentioned, that we couldn't find the book, and people were asking us about it, and we was talking about it, and he raised to me, Daruba did, that the book was being sold for $400 and some odd on Amazon or something. And we said we should probably try to reprint this book and get it reprinted again. Around the same time, a little after that, Matt came to me and asked me about doing this. And I told him that that was something we were thinking about doing, Daruba and I. And so it proceeded from there. But I first read it myself, because I wasn't locked up with the ones who actually wrote the book. I was in Africa when they wrote it.
Tell us, what does the title of the book mean, Look for Me in the Whirlwind?
That's come from a quote Marcus Garvey made. The brothers and sisters who wrote this book originally thought it would be a good title, based on what he was talking about at the time, Marcus Garvey.
Kevin Phillips, Ronald Reagan's speechwriter and advisor, called the Democratic Party capitalism's second favorite party. The Black Panther Party, on the other hand, had a political program which presented a nightmare challenge to the Democrats. You print in your book the Panther 10-point program. What do the Panthers stand for, and why is it relevant today?
Why the Black Panther Party is as relevant today is the 10-point platform and program. We want freedom. We want community control. We want an end to police violence and murder of black people. We want people freed from prison. It listed a 10 things that had to do with black self-determination and community control. And so what the Black Panther Party wanted was children to be fed, people to have access to health care, people to live in decent, affordable housing, all the same things that people want today. The difference is the Black Panther Party created survival programs with its 10-point platform and program that addressed those material needs of the people.
What did the government, and in particular the FBI, do to attack and destroy the Panthers?
There was a program that the FBI started, not just for the Black Panther Party, but for black organizations that they felt was a threat, called COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI against what they considered radical organizations. A lot of people don't realize that the Black Panther Party was really a community program. It was all about, like she was just saying, helping the community survive with free health clinics, free breakfast for children early in the morning before they went to school, food programs, giving bags of food away, giving shoes away in the winter, coats and things like that. That was what it was all about. But the federal government felt that it was a threat, because it was, to them, they thought it was some kind of communist threat because people were giving stuff away free, and the capitalist way is to sell. And it was a threat because it raised contradictions that in the community, here it is, that we used to tell them, here, we can feed you, we can feed your children before they go to school. Why can't your government that you give millions and millions of dollars to every year feed them? Why do we have to live in rat-infested housing and places where the garbage don't get picked up in the regularly and things like that? And we would raise the contradiction with these programs. And the people could see the contradiction. Yeah, if these guys and girls and women who don't have nothing can feed us, can help clothe us, can help house us, and come up with programs to support us, our government should be able to do that. And that's why we were so popular among the people at one point.
We titled this new edition, Look for Me in the Whirlwind, From the Panther 21 to 21st Century Revolutions, because we understand that those programs and also that the vicious repression from COINTELPRO that shut down the Panther Party and so many of those programs back in the late 60s and 70s are relevant today, both fronts. So yes, the idea that those kind of independent, militant, community-based programs are still necessary is clear, but it's also clear that COINTELPRO, under different forms and different names and using different strategies and tactics, continues. So when we dedicated this book, for example, to Panther 21 member Sundiata Okoli, who just turned, 82?
81.
81. Behind bars, Elder, who was actually, you know, a great mathematician and scientist, part of the Hidden Figures NASA back in the day, but now has spent decades and decades of his life behind bars for fighting for the freedom of his people.
Over 40 years.
We understand that shining a light on the current political prisoners and on the continuing COINTELPRO under different names that seek to repress our movements of today is necessary to combat and to at least understand. And so much of this we find to be mystified or invisibilized by the current law and disorder that we have in our world.
And Look for Me in the Whirlwind reprints the original program of the Black Panther Party.
Please talk, if you will, about the significance of the case of the New York Panther 21 and how it informs much of this book.
One of the things that I would point out is, first of all, it was one of the first mass incarceration, mass political incarceration. These were some of our first political prisoners here in this country. They were definitely some of our first in the Black Panther Party. Of course, there had been political prisoners going all the way back. You can go back to the Rosenbergs, etc. But this was mass arrests here. This wasn't just one or two people. This was they actually arrested about 23 people. And took to trial. I think it was 14, if I remember right. I'm not certain exactly how many it was. Some of us, like myself, two or three of us, I think it was four of us, that they tried to arrest, were able to evade the arrest and disappear, go underground. I wind up going over to Africa to help build the international section of the Black Panther Party, along with Larry Mack, who was another one that they wasn't able to capture.
What was so astounding were the charges, the conspiracy charges. You know, conspiracy is a thought crime. It's known as the prosecutor's darling because you don't have to actually prove that a crime was committed. You just have to prove that people thought about doing it. I mean, like, one of the charges that sticks in my mind was so ludicrous that the Panthers were planning to blow up the Bronx Botanical Garden, you know, and department stores and the Statue of Liberty. I mean, it's like ridiculous. But they did manage to hang up the party for quite a long time.
And that was the intent, right? Because the 21 was about the leadership, removing the leadership of the Black Panther Party here in New York, in Harlem, in the Bronx, as Sekou was part of the Bronx chapter as well. But that was it, to stop that work. And it did. It put a real damper in the work because, one, the leadership was taken off the streets, but also people were reduced to fundraising, right? They had to keep raising money for the legal fees. And it was about criminal criminalizing resistance. And so criminalizing those movements that people came from, and particularly the individuals within those movements. And we see that today with from J20. We see that with the Bronx 120, the young people up in the Bronx that have been arrested and charged with conspiracy. We see that, you know, the Panther 21 is a clear reminder of that quote, if they come for you in the morning, they're coming for me at night. Because there's always a beginning point. And the 21 was a beginning point of a mass arrest, and we've seen it continue to 2017.
Not to put too much of a simply legal frame on this, but it's worth saying that there are several legal strategies understood and in some ways employed on and after the Panther 21 case that are featured in the book. The great lawyer Haywood Burns actually has a major piece in the original volume that is reprinted here. We need to give a special shout out to Robert Boyle, a current leading attorney for many of the political prisoners, who in fact is not correctly and fully credited in the chapter in the book called Urban Police Repression, Criminalizing Resistance and Unraveling the FBI's COINTELPRO. It's credited to Daruba Bin Wahad, his lifelong friend and client. We'll let the two of them work out how Bob's name get left off this. But also, it's interesting to note that one of the 21 who contributed to this new volume with his own new reflections on these times is Shaba Ohm, who was also a co-plaintiff in the Hanshu case, which looked very, very clearly. It was a movement-wide case that looked clearly at security and police practices and in some ways put those policies on trial. And there's a slight section in this book about that case and Shaba Ohm's post-21 work in putting the police and FBI on trial.
Thank you, Matt. On May 13, 1971, the jury in the Panther 21 case returned a verdict of not guilty. Dequi, can you talk a bit about the toll that this trial exacted on the community?
And it's the same as when we talk about people in prison. It's their families, right? And so we have radicals and revolutionaries that were in the Black Panther Party who made a conscious choice, who developed into revolutionaries. But they had families. They had mothers and fathers and children. And the police did not discriminate against with their repression. It didn't matter that it was children. They visited people's schools, children's schools. They, you know, people got evicted. People lost their jobs because they visited their places of employment. People were harassed. I mean, people had helicopters flying over their homes. The level of repression was really, really intense. And so it created all kinds of post-traumatic stress, fractured families, not just a fractured movement, but fractured families. It was really a trying, just as it is today.
Exactly. You reminded me of how the FBI visits families and friends of activists. And the more successful, as you've mentioned, I think the more they do these intimidating visits and to sort of spread guilt by association.
Absolutely. And one of the things Sekou and I were talking about this morning on the way here is even when people are behind the wall, the difficulty that is imposed on them to even visit. So you have people, in this case, people were locked up for two years. And then, you know, people trying to visit people. I mean, just trying to live. So you're trying to live here on the outside with capitalism going amok and police repression and violence and poverty. And then you're trying to support families on the inside. So it puts extra burdens, emotional, financial, spiritual burdens on people.
It also put a real damper in the programs that the party was giving to the community. All the programs I spoke about earlier, the free breakfast for children programs, the welfare rights programs, the housing programs, the free clinic, health clinics. All those programs were interrupted by the attacks from the COINTELPRO, the government's counterintelligence program. That's another one of the ways that really hurt the community.
Could we talk just for a few minutes a little more specifically about the case of Sundiata Okoli? Why is this elder activist in prison now?
Just had a really punishment, and punishment for not just him, but for his organizations that he was part of, the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army, and as an example of what will be done to other activists if they step forward, especially intellectual ones. That he was someone, he wasn't just a bum in the street. A lot of us just come out of the streets from, really wasn't intellectual in that sense as Sundiata was. He was a real professional, and like Matt mentioned earlier, he was a mathematician. He had worked for NASA, and we attracted some of those type of people who wanted to do more with their time than just work for the government. They wanted to work for the people, and so this is a threat to them. If you come out here, we'll treat you just like we'll treat anybody, or we'll treat you maybe even worse, because we don't want your example there.
I also think that it's important to note that Sundiata is the co-defendant of Assata Shakur, who was liberated and escaped in 1979. And so there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of, you know, we're going to get you. We're never going to stop hunting for Assata. She has a $2 million reward on her head. Part of it is that Sundiata was given his last parole hearing. He was given a 15-year hit, which means that he's not eligible to go back before the parole board until he's 95 years old. And so his lawyers and we are raising funds to fight that in court. He's 80 years old. They're saying, come back when you're 95. So it's clear evidence that they want Sundiata to die behind the wall.
Yeah, well, they tried to kill him in that traffic stop. They shot Assata in the back. Yes. Later, she was freed from prison and is in Cuba now. I was with her there years ago when we went down there to put out a book about Cuba. At least she got out, but Sundiata is in trouble.
Well, this is also about Sundiata and this process, and I thank you for those comments. There is a website, just his name, sundiataokoli.org. That's SundiataAcoli, sundiataokoli.org. But, you know, Sundiata is one of many elder Panthers who are really being given, you know, what we call the death penalty. You know, Mumia was given the death penalty and got off death row, but by giving these elders 10, 15-year hits where they can't even apply for parole until well into, also just to say, being an elder in prison, it's not exactly the most conducive space to grow old. And I think there's no coincidence. We wrote, Dequi and I, in our introductions to the book, wrote each of us about the contemporary issues that suggest there's no coincidence between that 15-year hit that Sundiata got and things like the movement for Black Lives today. I just want to read a small portion from one of the introductions. Many have now heard of Assata and read her autobiography, and some in the movement for Black Lives wear T-shirts proclaiming, "Assata taught me." Yet when questioned about vital historical markers, people and places barely one step away from Assata herself, confusion or ignorance too often abounds. Leaders, current, contemporary, young leaders have been asked, have you heard about Sundiata Okoli? Are you familiar with Sekou Odinga? Do you know the name Daruba bin Wahad? All three are closely connected to Assata, both personally and politically, but their names and work, past and present, are practically unknown.
Thank you, Matt. You know, the book is really magnificent. It's over 600 pages. It's what you said before. It's a twofer. And I'd like you to please tell our audience what is in it in addition to the reprint of Look for Me in the Whirlwind. But there are photographs. There's poetry. Sundiata wrote The History of the Panthers. I mean, it's a real gold mine. Could you talk about that, please?
Yes, it's We have poetry from Afeni Shakur, who was one of the 21, who is now has made her transition about a year or two years ago. There is a piece from Look for Me in the Whirlwind by Bilal Sunni Ali, the major saxophone player. There are contemporary essays from the surviving members. So Sekou Odinga wrote a chapter, Daruba Ben-Wahad, Shaba Ohm, Jamal Joseph. There are, like you said, lots of pitches. The 10-point platform and program is in there. I've contributed an essay. Matt has contributed an essay. And so Sundiata has contributed to it. So it really is a then and now, and it is to contextualize. Because if you don't understand what's happening, many people don't understand what's happening today. Well, how could this happen? How could that happen? Well, you have to go back into history. And this is an attempt to contextualize the history of the Black Panther Party and the movements of what was going on at a particular time to help people understand the then and the now. So it is a great book because it is, as Sekou said, that, you know, you can't get that book unless you can pay a couple of $100 for Look for Me in the Whirlwind. So now you get two books in one, and you get to see where people's thoughts are today in addition to what was happening at another time.
And it's $26.95. It's not $400, right?
Exactly. So a major savings.
Excellent.
And a shout out to PM Press for putting it out.
Yeah.
I'm working on a book now, and my publisher told me we like to keep them under 160 pages because we don't make much money if they're longer than that. And PM really put its neck out to publish this 600-some page book.
Thank you,
PM.
Yes, indeed. And I think we've now under oath that we cannot give them any more books over 500 pages. I've reached my limit. But two things to piggyback on DeQuy's comments. In terms of the invisibilization of the Panthers, of the chapters we wrote, we actually co-wrote with one of the grassroots rank-and-file Panthers here from New York, Cyril Innes Bullwhip. But the title of that is Counting to 21. Because one cannot even Google the Panther 21 or Black Panther 21 and find 21 names. The history has been so invisibilized, been so buried, that the first thing we did was Sekou and I sat down and started looking at, well, who are the 21? And we realized we couldn't quite get it right. We keep getting to like 17, 18, then we get to like 24, 23. What is this 21 number? So it took actually a fair amount of research, and this is recounted in the book, to delineate why the 21 was 21, because this is not like a single group of people who all worked together as a unit of 21. There wasn't like a committee of 21 people in the Panthers back then.
Yeah, some of them didn't even know each other and were charged with a conspiracy.
Indeed, indeed. So we go through that, and where are they now? The other thing is we were very fortunate to have two major professional photographers, David Fenton and Steve Seamus, who have their own works published in many different places and in galleries, etc. But they looked through their old reels and they gifted us for this book some footage, some photographs that have never been seen anywhere before. Also, we've looked through some of our own collections. So you've got three sections of photos, original photos from David Fenton, original from Steve Seamus, and some from our own. In fact, a couple from Sekou's collection and Kathleen Cleaver's collection of their time in Algeria founding the Black Panther Party International.
The book is called Look for Me in the Whirlwind.
We have just a few minutes remaining. What do you see the legacy of the Black Panther Party being in terms of today's social justice movements?
Well, I think that one of the major components is that self-determination is so important, and that when people think that communities can't take care of their own needs, that it is possible, and that it is young people that are the force for change in any movements for any kind of change, right? That these were young people, poor and working class people, who said something is not right and we're gonna change it, and it was self-determination.
And I would say also a legacy is what she was saying was more of on a positive side. On a negative side, the legacy is that the government will do anything, absolutely anything, right down to murder and mayhem, which they committed on the Panther Party, to stop what they think is going to be a progressive threat to them. that's a main legacy that the government wanted to be put out there and was very successful in putting out there. And a lot of people have looked at that and said, I don't want to be involved. I'm scared of that. You know, people actually were afraid. A lot of people still are afraid to get involved on any militant level. They'll struggle, but not on a militant level. The government has said to them, we will make all revolutionaries dead revolutionaries.
We have in our room today at the studio three of the most knowledgeable and caring activists that I've ever known. And I'm curious that during the process of putting this book together, despite your decades of collective experience, did you learn anything from this? And does it leave you with any words of new advice to young people?
I think that one, I learned how difficult and challenging it is to put a book together. That's primary. But also the importance of context and study. You know, one of the things that the Black Panther Party did when people didn't know how to read, they learned how to read, right? They had a Black Panther newspaper. And so they held political education classes. As Sekou said, that with the survival programs, it helped to expose the contradictions. And so this book was a reminder of just how important it is to have political education, to study, as what Matt said about the Black Panther Party and that history being rendered invisible, like making that history visible, making those stories, right? What happened to people, what people did, what people imagined, what they dreamed of, what they envisioned, that those things are possible, that it is possible to make change. And the Black Panther Party created change. You know, people have paid for it tremendously with 40, 50 years in prison and people assassinated, people living in exile and families torn asunder. Some people still can't find jobs today because they were in the Black Panther Party. So there's a lot of trauma, but there's also a rich history of struggle that the Black Panther Party and doing this book reminded me about.
I want to sort of close on a positive note. There's some stuff that we do just get reminded about. We started this book, the very first words on the very first page are a quote from Pan-African historian John Heinrich Clark, who said, if people don't know where they have been and what they have been, they don't know what they are. They don't know where they're going to have to go. And I think in some ways this book helped all of us remember that piece. But I want to say something else also about the role of white folk and the question of solidarity and accountability. Just as this moment requires a certain intensified movement, intensified organization, intensified militancy, it also requires, in my evaluation, an intensified solidarity, a new way of looking at how we can be accountable to the Black Liberation Movement, to people like Sekou, the political prisoners, and the organizations that are being built today. And I have to say, in going through this process, that wasn't a new piece of information, but this was clear. It's also great fun. It's extraordinary fun. You know, and I've said this a lot since the book was published, except for the fact that we felt an urgency to get this out now, I could have spent years working on this book because every layer of the onion, every piece of the history that we get to another deeper, oh my God, you have that photograph? Wait a second, you think you've heard of a poem that was published back then but we don't have? Let's go and look for it. Every piece of that was so exciting and so vital, and there's so much more to do, both in uncovering the past and in building for the future.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Sekou. Thank you, Dequi. Look for Me in the Whirlwind. It just came out. Everybody should have this book and read it and cherish it. Thank you so much, folks,
for
being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
spectacle of Donald Trump and the palace intrigue in the White House has served daily to distract people from the political strategy and accomplishments of the radical right, which is taking over the Republican Party. Over time, the GOP has been transformed into an operation conducting a concerted effort to curb democratic rule in favor of capitalist interests in every branch of the government, whatever the consequences. It is marching ever closer to the ultimate goal of reshaping our Constitution to protect moneyed interests. This gradual takeover of a major political party happened steadily over several decades and often in plain sight. Duke Professor Nancy McLean exposes the architecture of this change and its ultimate aim. She has written that, quote, "Both my research and my observations as a citizen lead me to believe American democracy is in peril." Her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, has become an intellectual flashpoint and caused her to become the victim of a coordinated right-wing attack. She tells the long-overlooked story of James Buchanan, the political economist who developed the playbook for Charles Koch and his brother and their web of billionaires and millionaires who, beginning in the mid-2000s, have become a force to reckon with. To talk about the subversion of our democratic system from within is Professor Nancy McLean.
Nancy McLean, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
The Republican Party has been transformed both locally and nationally. It's no longer the party that, as you wrote, my father used to vote for. Today we're hoping to explore how the Republican Party has become an instrument of the far right. You argue that key to this story, what you call the missing piece, is understanding the rise of the billionaire radical right and its radical impact on our politics. There's a man named James McGill Buchanan. Tell us about him and how you learned about him.
Yes, well, what I learned is that James McGill Buchanan's ideas are what enabled Charles Koch to break through in his quest for radical transformation of our institutions after decades of pretty much ineffectual work on the margins. James McGill Buchanan was the first Nobel Prize winner to have been born in the U.S. South and to have worked most of his life in Southern institutions. He was the founder of a new school of thought called public choice economics, which is actually a broader tradition that includes people like Cass Sunstein, who worked for President Obama, and others. But his particular variant of that public choice school was the Virginia School of Political Economy, and he was always preoccupied with critiquing democracy as it existed in his early years, and then ultimately with prescribing measures by which it could be, in his words, enchained. And it was those ideas that Charles Koch picked up.
And what did Koch do to fund Buchanan? Can you talk a bit about the network of organizations and think tanks that Koch has set up?
Yes. Well, Koch, for years, was the single biggest funder on the radical libertarian right by a long stretch. So anybody who was on the libertarian right and looking for money went to Charles Koch. Now, James Buchanan, from his first years in Virginia in the late 1950s, had also broader corporate backing from some of the corporations often associated with the radical anti-New Deal right, you know, some of the fossil fuel companies, General Electric, and so forth. But by the late 1990s, 1997 in particular, Koch had become very frustrated with the inability of his minoritarian cause to make progress, and so he began to invest in a big way in Buchanan's center at the George Mason University. And since then, the center at George Mason has become the kind of academic base camp of this radical right. So the economics department there, something called the Mercatus Center, and the now renamed Scalia School of Law are all important components in the Koch-backed effort to transform the country. And they've actually become pipeline, and Koch asked for this. He wanted a kind of talent pipeline. He always said that their greatest problem was the shortage of talent. And so what they're doing is setting up institutions, little training centers at various other schools modeled on this George Mason case, where they churn out and train young operatives to go off and staff the various pieces of the apparatus, which now is huge. I mean, it is literally dozens and dozens of organizations, actually hundreds if you take into account all the affiliates of the State Policy Network and the international affiliates of something called the Atlas Network. So this is a huge operation, larger than either political party, and quite determined to effect radical change in our country.
What is Koch, you know, who I think you write is the seventh most wealthy person in America, what is Koch and his cohorts, what is their vision of a future society?
Well, it's very interesting what they say when they're trying to put it out, put their vision out popularly, is they talk a lot about liberty. They sometimes even then now call themselves the freedom movement. They talk about limited government and low taxes. But if you actually look at the works that most influenced Koch in his construction of that vision, and you look at what some of the people say in their own words our country would look like after success, what you see is an America that would be unrecognizable to your listeners. It's a place in which the three functions of government are maintaining the national defense, overseeing the rule of law, and ensuring social order. And beyond that, we are individually responsible for all of our needs. So ultimately, in their dream world, we have no Social Security, we have no Medicare, we have no public education. What we have instead is a great pressure for us to save as soon as we are sentient beings for our own future needs. And if we fail to save and fail to provide for them, then tough luck. We will be examples to others of what happens when you do not save. And I think you're seeing an enactment, if you will, of this vision in the discussion over health care. And, you know, Americans of both parties are wondering why it is that the Senate is, you know, rushing to push through the repeal of Obamacare and a health, you know, they've had different incarnations, but basically proposed policies that don't get more than 20% support in any poll. Usually it's about 12. They don't have majority support in any state in the country, and it's horrible in the view of most Americans, and yet the donor class is putting pressure on these Republican politicians to make them toe the line, or they will face a primary challenge, and forcing them to vote for something that their own constituents don't want. So it's actually gone so far, this transformation of the Republican Party into a delivery vehicle, that that party is pushing through the agenda of its wealthiest, most extreme right donor class rather than it's the voters whose support it needs to continue as a political party.
Well, they've targeted the state. Trump's main advisor, Steve Bannon, has said that he wants to destroy the state. One of his allies, Grover Norquist, famously said that he wants to shrink the government down to the size that it's so small that it can be drowned in a bathtub. What is their strategy to take down the liberal state?
Well, that is where Buchanan's ideas came in. And whereas other people in this, you know, some of your listeners might refer to them as neoliberal, others free market fundamentalists, whereas others in that milieu, like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, concentrated more on making the case for free markets, James Buchanan spent his career making the case against government and basically trying to take down, in his words, the understanding of public interest that prevailed at mid-century. The idea that all politicians should be seeking the public interest and all political actors, and then we'd try to persuade one another of our case for what that public interest was. And Buchanan instead looked at the incentives in politics. And so he focused particularly on how different groups made demands on public officials, or, you know, also corporations made demands on public officials and elected officials, and those elected officials in his terms, would have a self-interest in re-election so that they would try to, you know, appease multiple constituencies without worrying about the cost. And so he did have a very original interpretation of where deficits came from. Now, what the Koch team has done is taken his ideas and turned them into a strategy for kind of retrofitting American government. So the first part of that is to break down all the progressive groups that made demands on the state that would lead agreed to taxation, and any transfer of resources from one, you know, section of the population to another. So, so you know, all the radical attacks we've seen on unions in the last few years fall into this pattern. They're also attacking the American Association of Retirement People and trying to stir young people up against older people to say older people are getting money as they shouldn't. So lots of efforts to break up groups, also to privatize public resources and services. So they want to privatize ultimately social in the name, you know, they're saying reform, but they're not questioned about what they mean about that. But what they really ultimately want is the privatization of Social Security and Medicare, public lands, all the rest. And they want to do a whole series of radical policy changes that we probably don't have time for. But the key thing to know is they also want to lock those changes into constitutional amendments, both at the state level and the federal level. So they're actually pushing toward a constitutional convention, which we have not seen in this country since 1787, to achieve what the donor class would like to achieve and cannot achieve through the regular political process. And they've actually been extremely successful in gaining control of state governments. They now have full control over 25 states, both houses of the legislature and the governorship. And they're using those states to, in a sense, kind of trap the federal government and prevent the federal government from enacting workable progressive reforms, as they did with the Affordable Care Act, with not accepting Medicaid expansion. So it's a pretty radical vision. It's extremely strategic. And I argue in the book that you can't understand this strategy or its code without understanding the ideas of this guy, James McGill Buchanan.
Nancy, you made the statement that, quote, both my research and my observations as a citizen lead me to believe American democracy is in peril. Can you talk a bit about that? And is that why you wrote this wonderful book?
Yes. I feel like, in some ways, you know, all of what I've been saying kind of points to that conclusion that our democracy is in peril. And, you know, you can see this in many ways. I mean, I live in North Carolina now, one of the states that has been a laboratory for this, and it has just been utterly, radically transformed by this cause. And we could also point to things that we haven't talked about yet, like the extreme voter suppression bills, which they also want to lock into the Constitution at a constitutional convention. Voter suppression, extreme gerrymandering, refusal to abide by customary procedures in terms of transparency and full disclosure and proper hearings and so forth. It is just such a radical vision. And, you know, I know maybe some of your listeners will think that I am, you know, Chicken Little or something, you know, and that it couldn't possibly be that bad. And there I just have to say that as I was researching this book, so often I would just discover another wing of this, a deeper set of connections, and literally feel nausea, you know, as I was going through the sources or, you know, going through these websites. It just at the scope of this thing, it is huge, and it is very determined, it is very strategic, and I don't think people on the left adequately understand that at all. There's too much mocking of Trump's tweets and his foibles and his intelligence and so forth when this thing is really, really moving forward, and moving forward at an incredible pace in his administration while people are focused on his tweets and, again, his foibles. But I will say the single most important lesson that I hope that people take from reading my book is that this cause, this Koch-backed libertarian cause, is doing what it's doing in the ways that it's doing it because they know from repeated experience that they will never persuade a majority of their views. And so they have to go at it in this side way, what Koch has called the technology of transformation. And I think that if the vast majority of Americans understood what this cause wants, and if they understand what it wants and they reactivate their kind of civic institutions, turn off their electronics and commit to the political process, then I think that this cause will be defeated because, again, it is a small minority, but it's an extremely wealthy and determined and ideological minority.
We've been speaking with Nancy McLean, a professor at Duke, who wrote the terrific book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. Nancy, I can't tell you how grateful Heidi and I are for your good work on this, and we're so pleased to be able to interview you. I wanted to ask you about Gloria Steinem had observed after Trump was elected and put all these people into cabinet positions, all these far-right people. She said that he found a fox for every chicken coop.
And, that's a brilliant quote.
And that's certainly true. And I wanted your reaction to the nature of the cabinet and how it relates to the Koch project.
Yes. That is just a perfect quote in vintage Steinem, and it really captures the situation. There is actually less light, I think, between the Koch operations and the Trump administration than we've been led to believe. At the very minimum, he is looking to them for so many of his top appointments. The people who are in pivotal places come out of these, not out of the mainstream of the Republican Party, to the extent that there is a mainstream anymore, but what they would call the Republican establishment, but rather out of these Koch-led operations, which I said, you know, there are now, you know, dozens and dozens of these, but there are some particularly key ones, and those key ones have supplied many of Trump's senior leaders. By one researcher's calculation, about 70% of Trump's senior appointees come from these Koch operations, are veterans of it. So that's a pretty stunning figure for what was once a kind of a marginal part of the political spectrum. But they include certainly Mike Pence, his vice presidential candidate, who's deeply rooted in these operations. They include Mark Short, who is his the White House liaison to Congress, who's a key pivot person for legislation, and he actually comes out of Freedom Partners, which was the, you know, is the big dark money operation that the Koch, you know, donor network that the Kochs have run. So he knows very well what the donors want, and presumably can convey that to Congress. Who else? Scott Pruitt at the EPA is deeply, you know, involved, has been deeply involved in these Koch operations, and particularly their, you know, fossil fuel protection. Oh, and you mentioned Steve Bannon before and his desire to, as he puts it, deconstruct the administrative state. Well, somebody who represents that project in the Scalia School of Law at George Mason, Naomi Rao, was just named to a key agency that most citizens won't pay attention to, but is extremely important for regulation, and that is the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA. So, yes, there is definitely a fox presiding over every chicken coop.
Nancy,
and Betsy DeVos, we didn't even talk about her.
Nancy, speaking of dark money, a number of reviewers have placed your book as the companion to Jane Mayer's Dark Money. Do you think this is accurate?
Well, I'm honored by the comparison. Jane Mayer has done hugely important work as a journalist for the American people in first drawing our attention to the Koch brothers in her articles for The New Yorker some years ago. She wrote a brilliant article about my own state, North Carolina, called State for Sale, that focused on the Koch partner, Art Pope, who has led the effort within North Carolina. And her book is terrific at just, you know, showing readers that money trail and all of the things that it is funding. So I'm honored to be in that company, and I see my work as providing the story of the ideas behind this effort and how they have evolved over time, and also helping people to understand the mid-century Southern roots of all of this, that really the dream vision of this cause is, in a sense, to take us back to mid-century Virginia, I say, minus the segregation, and mid-century Virginia was the most oligarchic state in the country with extreme voter suppression, extreme gerrymandering, you know, a parsimonious provision for public needs despite its wealth, starving public school system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I have the story of the ideas and also of the legal angle, which is all important to understanding this, and also what the ultimate end game of these ideas is. So yes, I have been many ordinary readers are connecting Jane Mayer and I in their communications, and I'm flattered by the connection.
Nancy, your book, Democracy Unchained, has become an intellectual flashpoint. And you've been subjected to a torrent of abuse for that. For example, I understand that Jonah Goldberg, a senior editor at the National Review, threatened you, writing that you should worry about the, quote, libertarian super posse on my ass. What is the method of operation of the right-wingers who are going after you?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, I actually predicted in the book, I said, you know, in the later chapters, and I pointed to the case of Jane Mayer and climate scientists who have brought inconvenient truths to the public for this cause and been subjected to various efforts to smear them. So, you know, it's all... I felt that it was predictable and that I should anticipate it because this is how this cause plays, and their willingness to abuse power is part of my thesis. So in a sense, they're confirming it. But still, it is pretty stunning to see how deeply the contemporary right has degraded our public discourse, you know, in quotes like the one that you read, you know, coming from the senior editor of a you know, widely read publication. And I'm much more engaged with the real readers who have responded so well to the book and to the, you know, various kinds of mainstream publications from The Atlantic to The Guardian to Slate to New Republic to, I can't even keep track of them all, Alternate. You know, many, many others have actually, their reviewers have read the book, engaged the book, and been excited by it. And those are the people I really care to reach and to talk with.
I think that the other alarming success they've had is within the legal system and the kind of judges that they're getting appointed, the last one being Neil Gorsuch. But if they stack that, then we're really in trouble.
And can I just add, Michael, that that was actually a product of the Federalist Society, who groomed students for decades, conservative, to have them placed in judicial positions and higher up positions.
And you won't be surprised to know at this point that Koch was an early funder of that effort.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and has funded the Institute for Justice and a lot of these organizations that seem so marginal in their legal thinking that I think many legal scholars don't take them seriously. But again, because of the power they've achieved and the fact that they've been able to get cases to the Supreme Court and score some significant victories, they are really important to watch. And another thing, actually, that I think is important for people to know is that this Koch-led libertarian cause has also is also working to politicize judicial elections and to pump unheard-of amounts of cash into state judicial races to ensure that the state courts sign off on the radical changes that they're making in policies in states like, again, my own North Carolina.
Very moving, Nancy. Nancy McLean has written a wonderful book, which we heartily recommend to you, called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy, it's just a tremendous contribution you've made. Heidi and I are grateful to you, and we've loved this interview, and we wish you all the luck. You're going to be on tour. How do people get in touch with you so that we can know if you're speaking somewhere and people can come out and hear you?
Oh, thank you so much. And it has been such a pleasure talking to you guys. You have such an amazing show. If people go to the Penguin Random House book page for Democracy in Chains, they'll see a little orange logo that says On Tour. Tour spots are starting to be put in there.
Nancy, it's been an honor to have you on. Congratulations on a truly remarkable and timely book, Democracy in Chains.
Thank you so much, Heidi, and thank you, Michael.
You take it easy.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For those of you in the New York City area, I'm going to give you a tip on a program that you'd be interested in involving Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and another former guest, Ramona Africa. The program is called A Dialogue on White Supremacy. It's taking place Tuesday, January 9th at 6 p.m. at the Graduate Center, the Recital Hall on the first floor, Graduate Center, 365 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York. Hope you can make it. That's Tuesday, January 9th at 6 p.m.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.